Hello, this is Rabbi Jeff Sachs of Atid and Web Yeshiva with another installment in our Modern Jewish History series. Visit www.webyeshiva.org for the full array of our online interactive live shiurim and classes. Okay, good evening. Last time, when we last met, we were discussing our friend here, Napoleon. There he is in his well-known pose, people tell us that he suffered from ulcers and the hand on the stomach must have provided some relief or something like that. But that's, of course, you know, every cartoon of Napoleon we've ever seen looks like this. Just again to summarize, as Napoleon makes his way across Europe, conquering large swaths of Europe, even earlier in his career, in 1799, leading the French army into the Holy Land, where he doesn't have a terribly successful run of it. But of course, that provides us with those stories, perhaps apocryphal, of his encounter with Rabbi Nachman of Breslov. And depending upon which version of the Apocrypha you're listening to, Rabbi Nachman curses him or gives him mussar or tries to encourage him to use his power for the good, etc., etc., etc. I think, you know, we can be pretty confident that these stories are apocryphal. But this idea that the Jews would develop such a legend says something about the personality of, even at that point in 1799, when he's just general of the army, not yet the emperor of France, says something about this short man who cast a large shadow over all of Europe. But wherever he advances, so do civil rights and emancipation, technical emancipation, in which Jews become citizens and quite literally begin to leave the ghetto. The ghetto walls throughout Europe begin to be torn down. Although technically speaking, the Jews were given citizenship, were given emancipation by the National Assembly in 1791, in reality, it wasn't quite so simple. Similar to, you know, in the United States during the Civil War, the Emancipation Proclamation didn't actually free any slaves. And even at the end of the Civil War, even after the passage of the 16th Amendment, the 14th Amendment, I'm embarrassed, after the freeing of the slaves in the United States, that didn't mean the next morning African Americans woke up and were on equal footing with the people who yesterday had been the slave owners. As a matter of fact, it took about 100 years for the civil rights movement to make its way, its slow march towards freedom, and similarly, in Europe, it takes quite a while for the Jews to, or for European society to make room for that emancipation to have real meaning. And certainly it took 10 years minimally until under Napoleon's rule the Jews begin to exercise some of those freedoms. Now, of course, as some had foreseen and welcomed, and as some had foreseen and bemoaned, the Jews, the emancipation of the Jews, the granting of rights to the Jews, led to a certain amount of assimilation. This coincides with the rise of the reform movement, something we'll talk about in subsequent meetings, the rise of the reform movement, which begins, of course, in Germany, and makes its way to makes its way to France. Christian society does not embrace the Jew. Even after emancipation, and even after assimilation, this idea that there's something about Judaism, these were some of the questions that's posed to the Assembly of Jewish Notables that we talked about last time, that there's something about Jewish ritual, there's something about Jewish custom, there's something about halacha that sets the Jew, apart. So what happens? They emancipate the Jew. They give the Jew civil rights. The Jew largely, in many cases, welcomes the opportunity to enter mainstream French society, mainstream Christian society, and assimilates. Even if he doesn't convert to Christianity, he abandons Jewish practice. All of those things about the northeastern Ashkenazic Jews in the Alsace region, that they looked different, their customs were different, their dress was different, they had a different language, they didn't speak French, perhaps they spoke Yiddish, perhaps they spoke other languages, they're apart. They can't be part of French culture. Well, what happens when they assimilate? The Christians still don't embrace them. There's an irony here, because so much of what was being demanded of the Jews, one of the declarations that was being demanded of the Jew, was to say, we regard our Christian we regard our Christian fellow citizens as brothers. We are part of the fraternité, the brotherhood of being French citizens. We don't consider you to be other. And you know what? When the Jews make that declaration, the Christians still say, yes, but we consider you to be other. And this is an interesting phenomena. Until the modern period, anti-Semitism was largely religious anti-Semitism. The hatred of the Jew was largely a function of the Jew's relationship to his Judaism, that religion of the Christ killers, the non-Jews would say. You understand all of this voice I'm taking on is not my own. I'm channeling the feeling of others. And what happens when the Jew is open to what happens when the Jew is open to moving away from Jewish practice and Jewish ritual and Jewish custom? He's still hated, and the religious anti-Semitism is transferred to a different brand of anti-Semitism. What's the new? In what way does anti-Semitism begin to evolve? Any thoughts on that? The problem is no longer Judaism itself. Correct, Tilalea. Racial anti-Semitism, which reaches, of course, its crescendo with Nazism. But the seeds of this transformation from one brand of anti-Semitism to another begins here. Roxanne, I won't address your point because it would take us very far afield. I think it's more complicated than that. Perhaps we'll come back to that in a subsequent meeting. She makes a point about anti-Zionism. So we have this idea of racial anti-Semitism. It's not the Jews' connection to Judaism. There's something essential about the Jew. There's something essentially problematic in the eyes of the anti-Semite about the Jew himself. It's genetic, and therefore it doesn't matter if he's converted or not. He could be a devout Christian. He could be a devout Christian, the son of devout Christians. But it's in the hard wiring. And that, of course, again, reaches its crescendo in Nazism, but it has its seeds. The seeds are already planted. The seeds are already planted here 150 years earlier. This transformation from religious anti-Semitism to racial anti-Semitism is one of the major features of modern Jewish history, and it's something that will come back again and again and again and again. So because of this transformation, we see a new stereotype of the Jew. The Jew is seen as not merely being backward because he doesn't accept Christianity. He's not seen as being merely heretical because he maintains his connection to Judaism. He's seen as being subversive, as being a traitor, especially in a place like Alsace, which is on the border between France and Germany. Maybe he's a state within a state. Maybe the Jews constitute a state within a state. Maybe they're going to turn on us. And we see this rise of these types of... So again, Sherry asks, what about emancipation caused the shift from religious to racial anti-Semitism? So again, because as long as Jews across the board, 100%, were observant, so the dominant feature which set them apart from Christian society was adherence to Judaism. And the anti-Semitism expressed itself largely as a function of that most distinctive difference between us and them. Emancipation opens the door and the possibility that a Jew can now be part of the larger society. Before emancipation, a Jew's right of residence. Remember, you can't just go and buy property and set up your house and change your zip code or your area code whenever you'd like. You're allowed to live where the host nation says you're allowed to live. And the Jew's right of residence in any place in Europe is there because he's part of a tolerated minority. Your right to exist in France or in the states that make up what we call Germany today, or Italy, or any place, is a function of you being a member in good standing of the Jewish community. The Jewish community is a tolerated minority, and we are allowing them to stay here. Sometimes we're going to change our mind, and we're going to kick them out. That happens from time to time. Sometimes we're going to say the Jews can live here, but they can only live here behind these particular ghetto walls. But your right to live wherever it is that you're allowed to live is there as a function of your membership and good standing in the Jewish community. Once you've been emancipated, your right to residence is because you are a citizen of France. Since you're a citizen of France, you, the lowest Jew, and Napoleon himself, Lahavdil, are brothers. You're allowed to live here. You no longer need the organic connection to the Jewish community in order to exercise that right. And that opens, as many feared it would, the floodgates of assimilation. Once you become assimilated to one degree or another, the major difference between the Jew, the assimilated Jew, and the Christian society is no longer his adherence to Judaism. So therefore, religious anti-Semitism loses its teeth, and the anti-Semitic impulse has to find another distinguishing characteristic by which we can demonize and set them apart. It used to be they would say, look, they keep the Sabbath on a different day. Look, their customs keep them separate from us. Look, the fact that Jewish law allows them to take to take exorbitant interest on loans to Christians, etc., etc., etc. Now, these things are no longer the case. And they look to something else, and they say it's something built, hardwired into the Jew, whether he's wearing a kippotah and has long payas, or whether he looks just like any other middle-class bourgeoisie Frenchman. It's built in. It's in his fingerprints. It's a problem with the race, not with the religion. That's why you see this transformation come about. Again, in May of 1806, Napoleon had posed these 12 questions, all of which are meant to address this larger set of issues that I've been describing. And he convenes this assembly of Jewish notables. A year later, in February 1807, and last time we looked at these questions and responses that this assembly put forth. We mentioned that there was quite a bit of disingenuousness in some of their answers. In February 1807, Napoleon convenes what he called the Sanhedrin, or the Grand Sanhedrin, it's sometimes referred to. Sanhedrin in quotation marks. Here's this well-known image in all of the history books. You see this picture of the Sanhedrin. Because Napoleon understood that insofar as these were answers to halachic matters, it needed the imprint, it needed the stempel of the highest Jewish religious court, which in antiquity had been the Sanhedrin, the high court, which of course ceased to exist many centuries earlier. So he kind of creates an ersatz Sanhedrin, and he gathers together 71 members, again the same number as the Sanhedrin of old. This Napoleon Sanhedrin was made up of, it was about one-third laymen and two-third rabbis, although rabbis of all stripes, including Reform. They were not all Frenchmen. They were members of other places that Napoleon had already conquered, including, I think Italians and Germans, Jews from Amsterdam, etc. And the Sanhedrin, as it were, kind of gave a rubber stamp to what the Assembly of Jewish Notables had done. And they passed these nine resolutions on the following nine topics. The first one, again, if you recall what we talked about last time, some of these will be familiar to you. The first one is a resolution that upholds our prohibition against polygamy. Again, according to the Torah, technically speaking, a man can have more than one wife. For many centuries in Europe, Jews had not taken more than one wife. This idea was very off-putting to French society, that in principle Jews could be polygamous. Since around the year 1000, Rabbeinu Gershom had made a takana that forbade polygamy, even though in reality, long before Rabbeinu Gershom in the year 1000, Jews had not been practicing polygamy. So this was to say, yes, polygamy is forbidden by Jewish law, certainly by rabbinic custom. The second one, regarding civil divorce, stated that gittin, that Jewish divorce, are only valid if they are accompanied by a civil divorce. Remember, the modern state, the modern democratic state, the bureaucratic state, has an interest in regulating marriage, divorce. This is part of the secularization. These fields, particularly marriage and divorce, the third had to do with marriage. The third resolution was that similarly, religious marriage is valid only with an accompanying civil marriage or civil marriage license. Now, these are ideas to those of us that live in the West. These are ideas that are very common. Everybody understands. You get married. You have chuppah v'kiddushin. You also have to go to the city, the city hall and get a marriage license. And that has to be signed as well. Now, in America, for example, I don't know how it is elsewhere in Europe, but in America, there are certain people that are allowed to officiate at a wedding. There are certain people that are allowed to create the institution of marriage. If you go to the dog catcher and he pronounces you man and wife, you are not, in fact, married, neither in the eyes of the Torah nor in the eyes of the state of New York, because a dog catcher is not authorized to do that, and certainly not to perform a divorce. But the state of New York, the state of New Jersey, the state of Connecticut, whatever it is, grants authority to members of the clergy. Now, because of the separation of church and state, the state can't determine who's a member of the clergy. They can say if you're a Jewish clergyman, if you're recognized as a clergyman by a Jewish denomination, that's okay with us. If you're a Protestant, etc., etc. If you are a justice of the peace, if you're a judge, you are authorized to perform a marriage. If you are the captain of a ship at sea, you are authorized to perform a marriage. Why that is probably a function of the role that a ship's captain plays, the authority and autonomy that he has when the ship is at sea. But it's interesting, apparently only when the ship is at sea. But when it's docked, that's not the case, because then the ship is under the authority of the civilian authorities, or something like that. Yes, it's true that the ships would be at sea for a long time, and that's why captains would be granted that kind of authority. And yes, as somebody mentions in anonymous chat, there is a episode of Gilligan's Island that is predicated on this fact. But this idea that the civil society wants to control these things, or have a controlling hand in things that used to be the purview of the church. Who used to control marriage and divorce? The church. No longer. In the rise of the modern bureaucratic state, the state is taking precedence over the church. And if it's taking precedence over the church, it's certainly taking precedence over the synagogue. And it says that in matters of divorce and marriage, the state has to authorize what's going on, in addition to any religious ceremony that somebody wants. So when the rabbi performs the wedding and he also signs the marriage certificate as the officiating officer, he's not signing the marriage certificate for the city hall as the rabbi per se. He's signing the marriage certificate as a shaliach of the city hall, of the civil government, who authorizes. I mean, that's what anybody, if you've ever watched television, you know, what do they say at the end of the ceremony? We don't really do it so much in Jewish weddings, but he says, by the power vested in me by the state of California, I now pronounce you man and wife, you may kiss the bride. Right? In other words, it's true that he's performing a religious ceremony, but he's also serving as a functionary of the state. And this dates back to 1807. This dates back to the French Revolution. This dates back to the answers of the Sanhedrin. Now, again, they're not compromising halacha. They're not saying that a civil divorce is tantamount to a get. If you have a civil divorce and you don't have a get, a Jewish bill of divorce, you're still married halachically, and you cannot remarry. Either couple cannot remarry, although it's more complicated for the woman for the reasons that should be apparent. But they're saying you need to have, we, the Jewish community, admit that you need to have both. Similarly, partially more complicatedly, the Sanhedrin had to admit that in a case of intermarriage, a Jew and a Gentile that are married civilly, well, obviously, it's against the halakha. Obviously, there's no religious ceremony that the Sanhedrin could imagine that would be involved in this. But they had to admit that if a Jew and a Gentile are married civilly, then for the purposes of civil marriage, they are in fact married, even though they're not married halachically. But they admit that, in other words, it's a kind of circular reasoning. They're saying, if somebody's married civilly, then we admit that they're married civilly, even though Judaism does not recognize that. Why it was important for Napoleon to hear that is not clear, because it seems somewhat tautological. But they had to admit this point, that a civil intermarriage is in fact a civil intermarriage, even though it's meaningless halachically. They needed to make a statement that their non-Jewish fraternité, their non-Jewish French fellow citizens, were brethren. Remember, in the answers of the Assembly of Jewish Notables, there's some getting hooked up on this question of what constitutes brethren in terms of the brethren from whom you have to help and aid in times of trouble, etc., etc. So there's a statement that they view themselves as brethren to other French citizens, an idea, a kind of negation of, it's anachronistic to talk about Zionism at this point, but of a connection to Eretz Yisrael, that a notion that a Jew, wherever he is born, in France, in Germany, in England, in Italy, views the state as their fatherland. And they agree that they should play a part in defending the fatherland, that they play a part in defending the fatherland, and therefore they should have to serve in the army. The Jews admit that they would have to serve in the army, which again, to those of us in the West, this seems like this is kind of a passé notion, but it dates to here. And in fact, Jews do enter the French army. Some rise very high, perhaps none more famously than, a number of decades later, who'd you say, Esther? Dreyfus, Captain Alfred Dreyfus, who will be, of course, involved in a very famous parasha in the French army, which will have significant consequences on a particular Jewish journalist covering the Dreyfus affair, namely Theodor Herzl. Namely Theodor Herzl, whose 150th Yahrzeit we marked, 150th birthday rather, we marked this week. There were different statements about a notion that there's value in being involved in productive handicrafts and various occupations that had generally been, well, both off chicken and the egg, things the Jews did not participate in, and things that were not open to Jews, particularly things like manual labor and agriculture, and a kind of notion that these are worthy fields to enter. Again, this plays into a notion that the Jew, if he would enter general society, would be expected to contribute to the larger economic well-being of that society. And finally, a commitment that money lending, that Jews would not take interest from money lending to non-Jews, which of course had been we've all read Merchant of Venice, I assume, but that money lending was particularly negative function that Jews played in society, and this notion that that Jews would not take a ribbit from non-Jews. Again, the Torah does allow Jews to take interest from non-Jews, but it's not obligatory in the same way as, let's say, putting on tefillin or keeping Shabbat, and therefore the Sanhedrin agreed to these things. There is some irony here that, well, Sherry asks, if the Jews were in the business of money lending, how did they then make money? Well, precisely, they left that field of business and they went into other things. And again, Jews were often money lenders because many other occupations were not open to them. But now, in theory, we're opening the doors and allowing entree to other professions that Jews had not participated in. So people had to be retooled. The whole notion of the Sanhedrin, which was again to ratify, to give a kind of halachic imprimatur to the Jew entering general society, had an irony because it raised this question of, well, what is this Sanhedrin? The Sanhedrin was an ad hoc committee. After they submitted these resolutions, the Sanhedrin was disbanded. It was never imagined that it was going to be some kind of standing high court for Jewish affairs. But it itself became a target of these notions, which would rear their head again and again throughout modern history, that the Jews are part of this international cabal, that there's this connection between all the Jews throughout the world plotting against the state. This will of course remind you of the protocols of the Elders of Zion, the notion that there's this secret society of Jewish plotters and traitors and connivers trying to run the wheels of society. I mean, even in our own day, the notion that the Jews control Hollywood, etc. Lahavdil, between that and the other examples, people start pointing to this Sanhedrin. So there's a great irony here, a historical irony. The Sanhedrin is meant to be the rubber stamp to allow Jews to move forward into joining the ranks of general society, and it itself becomes the target of these kinds of suspicions of the Jew as other, the Jew as someone of dual loyalties, etc., etc., etc. Our friend Napoleon, of course, was doing other things besides worrying about Jewish law and custom. He was actually quite busy trying to conquer the rest of the world. By the spring of 1812, he's amassed an army of 500,000 soldiers in Poland. Remember, last time we talked about Napoleon and the Jews of Eastern Europe. In June, he invades Russia, thinking that he would be able to conquer that as well. But, of course, at this point, he had bitten off a bit more than he could chew. By September, he had reached Moscow and had been exhausted. The supply lines were depleted. The Russians, who realized that they have this massive continent behind them, could just retreat and retreat and retreat. They had a scorched earth policy and would just destroy their own fields and towns and villages as they retreated, leaving the French no way to resupply themselves, overextending their supply lines back to Western Europe, and ultimately the Russian winter just gets them. And there are different numbers, but the overwhelming majority of the French army is destroyed. There are even some, I think, that say that there were 500,000 that went in. There's some reports that only 10,000 came out. That may be something of an exaggeration, but the overwhelming majority of the French. This is, you know, this famous image of, oops, wait, pardon me, where'd it go? One sec. There you go. This famous image of the retreat from Moscow, this sad image if you compare this image of Napoleon to the more iconic one, you know. But this is what happened. It was this. By 1814, of course, Napoleon had to abdicate. He goes into exile. At a certain point, he comes back from exile and tries to regain control of France, which he does for a period of time, for apparently a reign of 100 days. And then, of course, he's once again sent into exile at Waterloo. That was your people, Esther. The British got him. But that wasn't you. Your family wasn't in Britain at that time. They were probably those Jews in Poland. Or something. In Russia, even with the arch enemy, even worse. But even though Napoleon suffers this, you know, terrible personal, professional, national defeat, in the end, history, of course, is the history of Napoleon. Because ultimately the ideas, whether he was sincere or whether he was being a machinator trying to control things for ulterior motives, history is the history of liberation. History is, Europe is the story of advancing civil rights, of equality, of liberty. And those ideas had a transformative impact on Eastern European Jewry. I mean, on all of Eastern Europe, but particularly, but certainly for our purposes, on Eastern European Jewry. Tehillah Leah points out that you can't put the genie back in the bottle. And these ideas, even though they are much slower to catch on in Eastern Europe, we'll talk about this again as we move on, there are phenomenal differences between Jewish society in Western Europe and Eastern Europe. Eastern Europe always was and remains up until... Pardon me one second, please.
Shlomi, I'm teaching.
Pardon me. Eastern Europe always was and remains a far more traditional society than Western Europe, for various reasons. But this idea of Jewish civil rights, of Jewish emancipation, of equal citizenship, of the Haskalah, of the Jewish Enlightenment, once it's out there, it can't be turned back. And even though it evolves differently in the East than the West, nevertheless, those ideas get into the water and have a transformative impact. Just like we have the legendary story of Napoleon and Rabbi Nachman of Breslov at the end of the 18th century, at the beginning of the 19th century, we have similar stories about Napoleon and Reb Shneur Zalman of Leidy, the founder of Chabad Hasidism, the Baal HaTanya, the author of that seminal Hasidic work, the Tanya. Stories, you know, legends probably about their actually meeting, but the stories do reflect a certain tension that the Eastern European rabbinic leadership had in regard to Napoleon. There was a sense of almost messianic fervor about Napoleon, not just amongst the Jews, but an idea that here was somebody, the first type person we've seen in centuries, who can conquer Europe, who can unite Europe, who can liberate Europe, not just Europe, the whole world. And there's almost a messianic fervor about him. People are living at a time of fantastic change and of great upheaval, and they see in this world war that's taking place in front of them a type of apocalypse of Milchemet Gog u'Magog. And again, not just the Jews, but also the Jews. See, and there's a debate. How do we view Napoleon? Should we in Eastern Europe support him? Should we welcome the idea that he's going to come and conquer, whether it's Tsar Alexander or whoever's controlling Poland, etc.? And particularly at this time, at the in the second, third generation of fourth generation of Hasidus, when there's so much inner tension within the Jewish community, how do we support? So there were certain admorim, there were certain Hasidic rebbes that spoke favorably of Napoleon. Now, what's the nafkamina? I mean, Jews weren't out there, actually, they weren't out there fighting for one side or the other. So it has more to do with how do we view the events that are surrounding us. Reb Shneur Zalman, however, famously opposed Napoleon. There's this letter that he writes to one of his followers, apparently, this sort of Moshe Meizels. This is a well-known letter. In all of the accounts, this appears. This letter of Reb Shneur Zalman, he says, "Should Napoleon be victorious, wealth among the Jews will be abundant." In other words, if Napoleon beats the Tsar, it'll be good for the Jews. But the hearts of Israel will be separated and distant from their Father in heaven. But if our master Alexander, the Tsar, will triumph, though poverty will be abundant, because things aren't necessarily so good economically for the Jews in Russia. So poverty will be abundant. I mean, it'll be the same as it is right now. But nevertheless, the heart of Israel will be bound and joined with their Father in heaven. For God's sakes, burn this letter. Apparently, the recipient didn't burn the letter, which is why we have it. But he understood that Napoleon, it's a two-edged sword. There are advantages for the Jews, but there's a danger for Judaism. He understood that what happened in Western Europe would happen in Eastern Europe. The same year that Napoleon is defeated in Moscow, Reb Shneur Zalman himself dies. Even though Napoleon was defeated, again, the ideas aren't vanquished. And although it takes quite a long time for it to play itself out in Eastern Europe, nevertheless, again, in Tilalea's apt phrase, the genie's out of the bottle. And that genie is very much the story of what happens throughout the remainder of Jewish history in Europe. The Jew entering general society, the impact that it has, the ambivalence that general society maintains towards the Jew, and the residual effects of the Jewish question, which undergoes transformation as well, is the set of things that remain as we make our march through the rest of modern Jewish history. Let me just look at what Rafi here writes. Though the French, according to Reb Shneur Zalman, would harm the Jews spiritually through emancipation, which leads to assimilation, the Russians later, under Nicholas I, would try to harm the Jewish soul. Certainly. No, certainly. In other words, Reb Shneur Zalman does not... there's of course, something interesting here, that Reb Shneur Zalman is saying this about our master Alexander the Tsar. We know that the Russian government was not so kind to Reb Shneur Zalman, having imprisoned him during the earlier battles between the Hasidim and the Misnagdim. But nevertheless, he understood, or he thought, that he was better to bet with the Russians than with the French, because even though there's a danger on each side, maybe the enemy you know is better than the enemy you don't know. And of course, things get worse and worse for the Jews in Russia as we will see. The devil, you know, right? Better the devil, you know. We will continue next week. If anyone has any questions or comments or thoughts as we go about our week, please feel free to email me at the email up in the chat box, saks@atid.org, and I will be happy to hear from you, and we will continue next week.